Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 178. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. He is someone I've really looked forward to speaking with. He is an absolute real estate expert, and that is to say the least. His name is Ken McElroy. Ken, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
George, thanks, man. Great to be on.
Now, for my viewers or my listeners who might not know your full backstory, it's fascinating. Can you get us up to speed on that?
Sure. It's I tell you what, it's overnight success, man. That's all I have to say. So,
a 20-year overnight success,
exactly.
Right?
honestly, when I was in college, I was trying to make rent, and my buddy said, "Hey, would you manage this apartment building?" And I'm like, "Well, how much does it pay? Is it free rent?" And he said, "Free rent." I said, "I'm in." So I started learning how to manage properties when I was finishing college, because, you know, I was racking up student debt and all that, trying to just get through. And I actually liked it. I liked it a lot. But I got to tell you, after about 3 months of what property I went to was not running very well. But I had a construction background, and I was like, how hard could it be to collect rent? You know, so I get in there. It was a nightmare, man. So I was like, okay, I know I have to fix this at least, so I don't have to work so hard. So I worked my butt off for like 90 days. The owner came over, great guy, pulled up with this brand new, you know, Mercedes. And he came in and got that, you know, that month's deposits. And he's like, "Hey, good job, man. I've turned this place around." And I was like, I swear to you, I go, "I am on the wrong side of the desk here. Like, I'm collecting rents and handing it over, and this guy's driving off to his new Mercedes." I said, how do I be on that side?" So I finished up university. I found one of the companies this was in downtown Seattle that was doing this. And it was a big company. They're huge now. They're based out of Seattle, and they were basically repositioning multifamily. They were doing fee management, and they were building, and they had a brokerage division, and it was a fairly good sized company, like 200 to 300 people. And that was my first job right out of college. And I said, I like this. I'm going to get my real estate license. And that was in the late 80s. And I never looked back. I ended up working for them for about 10 years. I got a lot of property management experience. I probably managed somewhere around 30,000 apartments up and down the West Coast, Oregon, California, Arizona. That's how I got to Arizona, which is where I am now. And I ended up opening an office for them in Las Vegas and moving there. And it was awesome. And so what happened was, all the guys I was managing properties for were awesome guys, but all they did was put capital together and buy stuff when the markets were down or reposition them. But they would turn over guys like me. So I was doing all the work. So they would come in and they'd buy a building for, say, 8 or 9 or 10 million bucks. Then they'd turn it over to me, and I would make it worth 12 or 13 or 14. And then they would sell it, and then we would get fired. You know, I was like, okay, this isn't a good model. So I was like, I need to figure out a way to buy these. But, you know, and so that's what I started to do. And so, you know, I started, honestly, I didn't have a lot of cash saved. I was making pretty good money, actually, at what I was doing. But I started buying single families. I started buying, you know, my first deal was a two bedroom, two bath. It cash flowed a couple $100 a month. Then the second one, I was like, okay, I just need like 15 or 20 of these things. And I'm managing these big projects. So then I said, okay, I'm going to start buying big projects. Right. And that's when I kind of went into the dark side. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to raise capital. I didn't know how to get big debt like that or anything, but I ended up buying a 182 unit building. So I made a big jump from a lot of small real estate to the big ones, but I was already managing. So I understood.
Is this in Vegas, Ken?
No, this was actually in Phoenix.
Okay.
So yeah. So I did do some stuff in Vegas. I sold those off, but the first big deal I did was in Phoenix. And so it turned out to be great, George. I still own my first property. I bought it for $9 million, 182 units. And the, you know, it's worth, gosh, close to 30 million now. Mm-hmm. And so I started learning about tax. I started learning about leverage and debt. And so fast forward, obviously now we got 250 people. We have 500 million in construction right now. We own 10,000 apartments. We have a big management company. We have a utility company, collection company, you know, resident screening company. We have a resident insurance company. So, you know, I've got all these verticals inside now. And so, I've just been super opportunistic, and I've been trying not to sell anything and try to take advantage of the tax benefits that that you get from depreciation and cost segregation and bonus depreciation, all the things that you get, cash flow and no tax. So now we built this big organization. I didn't know how to do any of it. You know, I was like, how do I hire a COO? How do I hire a CEO or a CFO and all that stuff? And I just kind of worked through it all. And now I met Robert Kiyosaki and Kim along the way. Quite honestly, I was just pitching them for money. I was in a group called YPO or EO, and I'm still in it. And my friend said, hey, I know this guy that wrote this book, Rich Dad Poor Dad. And it was not the success at the time. It was fairly new. And
so was this like
I just met him. Yeah, exactly right. Okay. Yeah, and I was kind of just starting out. Ross, my partner, and I were just kind of buying. At that time, we probably had a couple thousand units maybe.
Okay.
And I went and met Robert and Kim and pitched them a deal. And it took them a year to invest, which is not, you know, normal. A lot of, you know, the first they wanted to see how the team is and look at your track record and all that. So they did a lot of due diligence on us, just like a lot of our investors. And they ended up investing with us. And then Robert goes, hey, like I have this seminar company and this learning company. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, he's like, why don't you show up? So one day I showed up and that was it. He's like, hey, get on stage here. And so he pulls me up on stage, and that's the first time I publicly spoke. And I was like, okay, what am I doing? Like, and he's like, just tell him what you know. And so I did that. And next thing you know, I was, you know, I wrote a couple books on the subject and was touring around with him. And I actually enjoy teaching. And so I just kind of embraced that. And so now I just cranking books out. I love doing these YouTube videos and trying to help people. I donate all our proceeds for the speaking and the books and everything to our charity, which we have. So obviously I make all my money in real estate, but it's awesome because no speech is the same, you know, because whatever I'm working on at the time, that's what I talk about. And
yeah, right.
So it's not boring to me. It's not canned. And so I really enjoy it.
Yeah. That's the exact same way I do my whiteboard videos. It's basically whatever I'm thinking about it at the time. That's what a whiteboard video is. So if anyone wants to know what's going in through my mind, just look at my most recent whiteboard videos. And that pretty much tells the story right there. You know, just to clarify, and you and Robert are he's still investing with you today. I mean, every time I've gone out to I got to write another book so I can give Ken more money and he can make us more money.
I know. You know what? They've been such great advocates of us, and obviously because we've done well for them. And, it's all George. The thing about this business is being disciplined and not buying when things are crazy and, you know, cap rates are really low and occupancies are really high and there's not a lot of room to move the building. And if you're just basing it on capital gain, it's going to be higher next year. That's a very bad strategy.
Right.
So we try to buy things where we force the equity. So I like to find broken things and stuff that has 3, 4, 5, 6, even $10 million of value. And believe it or not, you can find that and then put a management team around it and force it. And I like that. And then if I hit it right, I get the market too. And if I put right the good debt on it and all that stuff, you know, then inflation helps a bit, you know, so all that stuff. And that's all I've done. And then I got to this cash flow point where we have tons of cash. I mean, we have millions a month in net cash flow coming out of our deals.
Right.
And we have very happy investors. And they, they just keep trying to shove more and more and more money at us. But, you know, we have to be very disciplined because the market can...
At a certain point, it becomes tough to scale. Then it can. You just, I mean, it's bad. It's a good problem to have, but you got too much money and not enough deals.
We definitely had that issue, and we you know, finding deals. We have acquisition guys that work for us, flying around the country, finding stuff, but it's not unusual for us to, you know, be, and you know, there'll be 20 offers, 30 offers on a project. We just offered on a deal in Arlington, Texas, and there were 25 offers. We got the best and final, which is the top five, and we ended up taking third, and that's pretty normal for us. And you know, but there's a point where you don't want to push, because we were up against some 1031 buyers and some, you know, some guys that had put some funds together that, you know, they have pressure on putting that money out. So and we're kind of doing one-off raises, and so we don't want to play that game, because now all of a sudden our returns are not great. So
in other words, you're competing with people who are willing to overpay.
Yes, and exactly right.
Okay, so I've got a lot of questions there. The first question that comes to mind is, what is the environment like today in your business compared to what it was like in 2011 and 2012? That's when I got involved with real estate investing. I've never done the multifamily and the commercial like you have. I've just done single family residential. But I'd be curious to know, you know, what it was like. Did you have multiple bids back then, or was it just the complete opposite, where there was tons of deal, not enough money? Now there's too much money, not enough deals? Or
So great question. So what happened in 08 and 09, as everything was falling apart, there was nobody was talking about a value add. People, banks were just like, you know, hey, take this toxic real estate off of our balance sheet. And, and so, because banks were taking stuff back from the prior cycle. So what was really cool, George, is that we were buying properties back then, mostly in Texas, and we actually bought it with Canadian money, because the U.S. was toast. Like, everybody was freaking out. There was the people weren't throwing money at real estate at that time. So I went out of the country. We put together a fund in Canada, and we started using Canadian money. And the reason why that worked so well is because the Canadian dollar at the time was about par with the U.S. dollar. They were like, oh, okay, this is unsafe. And then what happened was the U.S. dollar got stronger, so the returns got even better because of that arbitrage.
In Canadian dollars, right?
Yeah, but we could have never seen that coming, but that was a nice little benefit. But what we did is we started buying assets. I'll give you one story. We bought a 680-unit building from Bank of America, and it was 50% occupied. So you can imagine we had 300 vacants. And I'm salivating, they had it on their books for about $28 million. We got them to write down their loans to about low 20s. And so they took a nice $6 or $7 million haircut, but you can't finance that stuff because it's not financeable. So they, you know, they're looking at our team. This is why the team, the track record and all that's so important. They said, okay. You know, and I showed them how we're going to pull it off. And I said, it's going to take about 18 months to 2 years in order to turn this thing around, because one, we had 300 vacant. And then we also knew that at least 100 of the people that were living there probably shouldn't have been there. So we're going to have at least another 100 move outs. So, which was true, in about 90 to 120 days, I have 400 vacants. And so, but you know, the truth is, George, you just put a team around it. And so I raised $7.5 million. I ended up getting the loan for about 20, which they financed. And so now I'm into the thing for right around $28 million. But I knew when I stabilized it, it was going to be worth about 40 at a 6 cap. So, you know, you just go forward. Okay, what are the rents today? What are the expenses? You know, how's that going to pro forma out? And so that's how you raise money. You raise money based on that. And so smart investors can see that, they, you know, as long as you have the team. And so the bank, it's super complicated how we structured it with interest reserves and all that kind of stuff, because obviously there's not enough income to pay for the debt and all that stuff. But the bottom line, it took about 18 months to fix the building, turn it around, get it to break even, start to get it to cash flow. Then you take it to another bank,
right,
and you get an appraisal and you say, listen, you know, here's a stable asset. And the appraisal came in right around 40. They gave us around 30. I'm going off of memory here. But so we pay off the 20 to Bank of America. We gave this $7.5 million back to the investors that got us there. And we had another $2.5 million that we distributed amongst everybody. And now everybody's in it infinitely. They have no investment. And the thing kicks off, you know, $600,000-$800,000 a year.
Right.
And we still own that building. And so it's obviously worth significantly more now. But that's been our model the whole time. And that was what was going on in 2010, 2011, as the banks were, just trying to get those toxic assets off their books. And it wasn't until about 12 to 13 to 14, George, that we actually had what I call the second bite of the apple, which was the value add, so we bought it here. And then the rents were going up and we're saying, now we can value out our own projects. So then we recapitalized most of our stuff and brought it up to that next level. And then you go back to the bank, you refinance again, and then you scoop more money out and you distribute it to everybody and you put a little bit more debt on it because your income's gone up. And so that's been our model the whole time. And during that period of time, it was rough. People were taking water into their boats and things weren't good. And I was like, that's the time that you buy.
Yeah, right. What would be an example in your business of a value add?
So there was a couple of things that we did which were layups. So the first thing I always said to everybody was, if it has washer and dryer hookups in the units and no washers and dryers, I want the property. Because I knew that was $60 to $75 a month in rent. So the washer and dryer cost me $500. I buy, let's say, 250 of them or 300 of them. I put them in each unit. I give them to the resident for free. When their lease renews, now they don't have to run down with their quarters into the laundry room. That's a massive value add because every single unit that has a washer and dryer hookup, let's say, gets $75 a month. So that's one really easy one that a lot of people can wrap their head around. The other one,
the whole entire property feel more high end.
Yeah, right. So you give everyone a washer and dryer. The residents are happy as heck when they're. And I said, listen, when your lease is up, of course we're going to charge you for that. But for now, free use, and now you don't have to run down the laundry room, which is already costing them $40-$50 in quarters, or whatever they're spending, $1.50, $2.50 a load. And so now they can just do it in their own home. And so what that does, if you take $75 times, let's say, 200 units times 12, throw some little vacancy on there and cap it, it's like a $3 or $4 million value add just by washers and dryers. And I've only spent $500 times, let's say, 250. So, I'm into it for $150,000. And we've created this massive value add. So that's a really easy value. There's value adds all over on unit pricing, as an example, on renovating. So we'll step into stuff that has, the really old appliances and, really old carpet, and we'll put wood flooring in, and we'll put, nickel, new cabinets and all the stuff and just totally renovate it, put new granite countertops in. Might spend $10,000 in a unit, but we might get $150, $200 a month in rent. And so those are all, once you do all of that, then you go to the bank and you're getting the rents and they're giving you a higher loan because your income's a lot higher. So, and then again, I just say that's another bite at the apple. So not every deal's like that.
Yeah.
But we found so many ways to do value adds. And those are a couple of really good examples.
Yeah, for sure. So initially back in the crash, let's say, it was all about buying a dollar for 50 cents.
100%.
Getting the people in there and just getting the right people in there, getting rents up to what they should be, then refinancing. So you get all your cash out plus some. And then
that's right.
Age in 2014, let's say, is to take some of those same properties that have a lot of upside opportunity and remodel them, for lack of a better word, or repurpose them. And then you just do the exact same thing. It increases the value because you're increasing the cash flow. Then you go right back to the bank, you extract that value and put it to work somewhere else and just keep the game going. It's really awesome. I'm curious though, what is the hardest part about that business? Because I know just the little things that I've done at a very small scale, it always goes back to property management. That's the toughest nut to crack. If you can figure that out, the rest is not easy, but it's a lot easier. Is that similar with what you do?
100%, George. That's why now I look back at my beginnings and I'm like, that was really, really, I was really lucky. I flew to Texas last week. Actually, right up the day after you and I had dinner, I went to Texas that next day, and I actually went to that property, the 680 unit. And then we also have another one there that's 440 units that are near each other, like a block away. And I just spent the day there, you know, walking units. It's block and tackling, man. It's like really basic. You know, what are the rents? Is this renovated, not renovated? How quickly are we getting these done? How quickly are we leasing these? You know, it's very different now with COVID and the pandemic, but you know, it's really a pretty basic business. If you put a good resident in there, they're going to be there a long time. They're going to pay you rent. We don't have hardly any delinquency or evictions or anything like that historically. We do have a little bit more of that now, obviously, because of the pandemic. But that's a very different issue. Those are really good people that are in a bad situation, but they were just fine when they moved in. And so, you know, if you just are really, really tight with who you put in, then all your problems are a lot easier. But then from there can be a lot of mistakes at the site level on how much they spend at the property, how much they rent something for, how they treat people. You know, it's a customer service business, as you can imagine.
Yeah, for sure. So how has we'll call it the cerveza sickness for YouTube here, how has that affected your business? Because I know a lot of people watch my channel to get kind of macro information. And a lot of them are concerned by potentially going into real estate as an investment that, oh my gosh, you know, if we really struggle in 2020 and then into 2021, it's going to be harder to collect rent. So real estate might not be as good of an investment. And what I usually come back with is, well, it depends on where your property is and how desirable your property is for a potential renter. So what I like to do is just buy residential starter homes in very good neighborhoods with great school districts. So even if you do have high unemployment, people are going to kind of go down the totem pole, the housing totem pole, so to speak. And that person that was potentially buying a $300,000 house is now maybe your renter at $1,500 a month or something like that. But how has this whole situation affected you guys, your rents, your cash flows? What are you seeing on your end?
Well, so it affected our whole industry pretty rough. I mean, you know, not only do we have moratoriums in the individual states and by Trump and the CDC, and that's getting kicked into next year. They basically are saying, you know, hey, we know that you guys owe the lender, but they don't have to pay you if they can't, if they can prove the hardship. And by the way, I get that. I'm just saying that is what it is. And so obviously we have a number of people that are in that scenario. And so we have rent collection issues. We have tour issues. So when people want to move in, you know, all that had to be buttoned up on, you know, how do you do virtual tours? How do you do virtual rentals, virtual rent collection, all of that stuff. Our company was already pretty progressive around most of that. So that part didn't affect us as much, but you know, we have employees with COVID, we have residents with COVID, we had all the PPE stuff that we had to follow, and we had to shut everything down. And so the whole industry got hurt pretty good. Ironically though, as people stayed home, they didn't move around as much. And so we didn't have, you know, people moving. Mm. They were like sitting in place. And so whatever your occupancy was in mid-March, man, that's where you were, you know, in April. Yeah, largely. And so there wasn't a lot of people moving around. So that was a benefit. But, you know, on a macro level, you know, I have friends, you know, when you talk about commercial real estate, you know, really you got hotels, industrial, you got malls, you got retail, you've got data centers, you've got hotels, or, you know, boutique hotels, big hotels. So, you know, and then in multifamily, you got class A, class B, class C. Class A is kind of the new stuff. Class B is, you know, maybe that 10-year-old stuff. And then class C would be, you know, more of the affordable housing stuff as an example. So those are all very different. And depending on where they are, you know, you have very different outcomes. So like I have property in Houston, Texas, and it got hit pretty hard with oil. And so it doesn't really matter if it's an A, B, or C, you know, it's an industry issue. And so same thing in Tulsa, we have property in Oklahoma, and same kind of stuff. And so But then fast forward, you might go over where we have something near, let's say, a healthcare campus like in San Antonio, and it's doing really, really, really well. So it's a lot of it's based largely on who's in your property, and then what they're located near.
So how's it working out with the banks, Ken? Because I know your renters can say, "Oh, well, we can't, pay you rent this month, or we'll pay you in 6 months because of, the Surveys of Sickness or the CARES Act or whatever moratorium." But the bank has to take that into consideration, I'd imagine. So how's that work?
Banks are non-forgiving, George.
Okay.
But no. Let's just put it this way. We've chosen not to go to any of them. Okay. And now I have friends that have had to, and we had one property in Oklahoma. So let me back up. So part of the reason why we never had to is because I'm a big fan of massive reserves for things that I don't see. Mm-hmm. And so we had a lot of money in reserves for all the properties. And I was like, listen, guys, it could be a fire. It could be a windstorm. We've had all that. We had tornadoes. We had hurricanes. We've had all that stuff hit our projects. There are times, like we had one project in Houston where I lost over 100 units in Hurricane Ike. Well, I had to pay a guy $165,000 just to clean up the site before insurance kicked in. So there are times there's money that you need to run big projects. And so I always was pretty heavy on the reserve side. We had one property in Oklahoma that the residents were having a tough time, and we were dipping down into into our reserves and all that stuff. And so luckily we didn't have to put the lenders on notice or anything like that. And like it or not, when you choose to not pay, I'm not saying that people don't have to, aren't in that situation, but when you choose that, like it or not, that's going to be asked later. And so I didn't want to be in a position to where I said, we didn't pay on all these. And oh, by the way, I'm fine now. Can you give me another loan? So I know that they look at my history. They look at my payment history. All that stuff is predicated on the types of loans I get, the interest rates I get, the terms I get, so you can negotiate on all that stuff. So we chose not to go down that route, but I have tons of friends in retail and office. They don't have that easy. They're collecting 10, 20, 30%. And, they're just trying to, protect their nest egg somehow.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for. I want to make a couple points there. Number one is, and I don't want to say anyone's doing business poorly or anything like that. I don't want to throw anyone under the bus. But when I talk about allowing businesses to fail, this is one reason why I say that, because in free market capitalism, like Milton Friedman has always said, the loss is just as important, if not more important, than the profit because of Schumpeter's creative destruction. So those players that are in the game that are, let's say, a little weaker, may not have the cash reserves or didn't save for a rainy day, they go out of business. And the people that were more prudent, that ran their business better, they come in and take the assets over and the entire economy becomes stronger as a result. So next time you see the government coming in and propping up businesses that maybe should have failed, just remember that we're making our economy weaker in the long run by not allowing people like Ken, who make good business decisions, to come in and take over those assets. So I just want to say that first and foremost. And then secondly, a lot of people talk about, well, you know, I can't get a loan, or how do I use other people's money, or I don't have any money of my own. And it's all about relationships. And it, you know, you came from nothing. I came from nothing, but we are somehow able to, over time, build relationships with the bank. Now, again, I'm a little fish compared to you, but the relationship I have with my bank in Kansas City, they took a risk on me because I was an entrepreneur. I really had no W-2 income or anything that would be typical, like a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. So they took a risk on me. Well, I've paid them many times over the years. You never missed a payment on a line of credit or any loan I've had with them. So now if we have another downturn, you know, you go back to them and they're going to be much more likely to lend to you. So you just made a great point where now you're really using this as an opportunity to make your relationship with your banks even stronger. So the next time you go back to them, they're going to remember, oh, remember what happened back during the cervasis sickness? This Ken guy paid us, even though he was getting stretched, even though his renters weren't paying him, he never missed a payment. And they're going to say, how much money do you need, Ken? I'm assuming, am I right there?
Yes, that's right, George. I mean, I know there's a lot of legislation around this, but the truth is it matters. If you're not paying somebody, it matters. And so, yeah, so I'm a rainy day guy. I'm like, listen, there are things that are going to go wrong. I don't know what they are going to be next, but they will. And so let's have a reserve here. And it might be a roof. It might be a hailstorm, which we had. We had a hailstorm break 40% of our windows in one of our properties in Oklahoma City, 40% on a 256 unit property. We had a hurricane. We've had tornadoes. We've had lots of fires. And so those are real things. And so just over the years, I've like, listen, we're going to have plenty of reserves. And then let's never get into position where we don't pay the lender, because they're our lifeblood for new deals. You know, as you know, debt in the future is going to be an asset, right?
So
that's all I'm thinking about is, how do we make these guys whole? How do we continue our relationship with these lenders over the long haul? And these guys move around, and, you know, and I'm in a database somewhere, trust me. And so whether it's said or not said, they know if I'm paying on time. And no matter, you know, they all share data just like we all do. And it's important.
Yeah, for sure. I want to touch on a video you did on your YouTube channel that I just got done watching this morning that was fantastic. So for any of you who want to subscribe to a real estate, kind of a macro-ish real estate focused YouTube channel, definitely check out Ken's. It's just his name, Ken McElroy. He's got probably 175,000 subscribers. The channel is just completely blown up. It's incredible information. But you had this video of maybe 20 minutes on how you saw some potential, let's say, for a real estate crash. When I mean real estate, I mean residential, in 2021. And you really, but you didn't just say, oh, here it is, and just kind of make it, sensationalize it. You gave data points, you used charts, you went to specific websites and said, this is why, you kind of built a case and a story. So can you kind of give us the Reader's Digest version of that video?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Thank you. By the way, I really have enjoyed this. Since COVID hit, man, I was like, hey, let's get going on this YouTube channel. It's just been, going nuts. And I love it. But to answer your point, when we invest big money into property, wherever it is, George, I have to know everything. I have to know what the schools are like. I have to know if the employers are moving in, moving out, if they're contracting, expanding. I want to know everything. I want to know house prices. Those are all what I call our must-haves on any particular market. And so when I look at whatever it is I'm looking at, I'm all about the data, the demographics, you know, and the migration patterns on where people are going. And you can find that stuff at a state level, a city level, even a submarket level, if you really, really do your homework. And so the reason why I did that video is because I think everybody lumps real estate into this big bucket as if it's one thing, and it's not. You know, it's like saying, you know, stocks are one thing, you know, there's, and so, so what I saw and what I still see is the reason I don't blame people. Nobody wanted people to go through their homes during the pandemic. And so the listings dried up. And so I think there's like two months of listings or something. I read the other day that there's like four real estate agents or five to one listing or something. It's something crazy. So, you know, so whatever, that's a supply demand thing. It's just that simple. And so there's a lot of people chasing a lower supply. Of course, it's going to drive prices up. And then, you know, you throw the low federal funds rate and the interest rates on top of that, it's just going to get, it's going to get hot. That's okay. But, you know, recognize it for what it is. That's all. And so as people are moving around, and they are, you know, everybody's kind of picking on these big urban centers, and there's nothing wrong with that because they probably deserve it. And they, you know, people are moving out of those places, but they're blowing up these submarkets, you know, and some of them are in other states, some of them are right next door. And so my point was that, you know, just, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, it's going to continue. But the bigger thing for me was taking real notice on the two things that I follow, which are mortgage defaults and evictions. And so right now we know today there's at least 12 million people that owe around $6,000 in rent, period, right now. So, and so they're all kind of hanging on. So you got 12 million people that are going to probably hit at some point in next year. So you have that disruption, and we could talk for an hour on that. You know, who knows where they'll all end up.
And they, on average, they owe $6,000 on their mortgage.
On their rent.
On the rents. Okay.
Yeah. On their rent. And then jump over to, you know, I go to Mortgage Bankers Association or Black Knight or the two that I really like. Okay. You look there, there's 4 million people that are in the process of some kind of forbearance or default. And so you have these two big things happening at the same time. And all I'm saying is, I think that we're gonna see a lot of listings next year, and here's why. I think the vaccine is gonna relax some of the things, and people have had a nice little run up, and maybe they're behind, maybe they're not behind, but I think you're gonna see a lot more listings, at least people that would have been listed last year. And they want to move or whatever, get nearer their family or maybe their jobs are dislocated or whatever. I think you're going to see that. So I do think you're going to see all this listings happen in 2021. I think it's going to be crazy as people try to scoop whatever equity they have, pay off whatever they owe.
I'm sorry to cut you off, Ken, but that was a really interesting point you made in the video, that a lot of people, because the unemployment rate will potentially get higher because all these businesses going out of business once the stimulus runs out, and you got all these unemployed people that may have quite a bit of home equity because the prices have risen so much. They're going to want to cash out because they don't have a choice. That creates more supply coming online.
100%. So they're I call it house rich, cash poor. Mm-hmm. And also a chance for a new life. If they've got, let's say they live, you know, near San Francisco and they work for Twitter. Well, they probably have a lot of equity moving, I guess. They're going to move an hour away or maybe to another state. And if Twitter allows that, and they're going to buy something for half, they're going to have all this cash and they're going to be fine. So all that's happening right now. So that's going to be a listing. And then in addition to that, I believe that you're going to see this forbearance. It has to come to a head soon. These people owe money, they owe rent, and they owe mortgages. And at some point, somebody's going to pay for that. You know, it's either going to be the bank, it's going to be the landlord, it's going to be the resident, it's going to be somebody. And a lot of that's going to make itself up into into Wall Street, as you know, because a lot of those loans are sold off. And so there's a lot of landlords I know that own homes that are not getting rent, and they're trying to work with their lenders. And by the way, there's private lenders and government lenders. And so the government lenders are under the CARES Act, but the private ones are not. Right. And so, you know, there's a lot going on right now. And I think, you know, and I really think that the spike in the cerveza that you call it, and the spike in that, and then the vaccine, you know, there's going to be a lag on the rollout. You know, we're going to have another bad year, and these businesses that are just been hanging on, maybe bleeding cash, I don't know. It's going to be a lot worse next year.
The release valve is home equity. That's what you got on your balance sheet. That's the liquidity, let's say, on your balance sheet that you can access in when times are super tough and there's low supply because no one wants to sell their house. But when people do want to or have to sell their house, you get more supply. You gave a couple tips at the end of the video for people that might, again, you went back to the point that real estate is local for the most part. And there's a couple times, every once in a while, you get real estate all going down at once, but that's very, very rare. So real estate, and you even said in 2021, you don't see it going down in unison like, let's say, 2008, 9, 10. It's going to be local. But the tips that you gave were, number one, check inventories. And then I think you use Zillow as a reference there. And number two, make sure that you're always aware of the inflows and outflows of population within the region you're looking to buy or sell. And you had some really cool kind of things that I never would have thought of. One was you look at the driver's license.
Yeah.
Or how many people are turning in their driver's license in, let's say, Boise, Idaho. That means there's more people moving there because you have to get a new license, the local license, within 30 days or something. And then also you gave a website for like a moving company, like a national moving company. So you can see where people were actually moving to state by state. So can you walk us through those little
secrets? Well, I'll tell you what. We'll put that up on Ken McElroy and Tom, KenMcElroy.com, Rebel Capitalist. How's that? And then we'll put the tips up for your people. If you know, I might as well do that. But yeah, so here's the thing. Again, back to the data points. U-Haul. You know, if somebody rents a U-Haul from New York to Phoenix, it's a data point. Period. Same with North American Van Lines. Same with Atlas Van Lines. You know, same with all those companies. So those are really, really, in my opinion, low-hanging fruit. You Google that right now, it's going to come up. You're going to see where all those U-Hauls go, whether they're one-way, two-way. Typically, they're one-way. But those are really important. The post office, you know, when you go and you register, you change your address and all that, that's all up on the government website. The, as I mentioned before, the Department of Motor Vehicles is another one. And you know, and now, this is kind of creepy, but now they're doing it with cell phones. Like, like it or not, if you and I were talking before here, we might go skiing somewhere, like let's say in Utah. There's people that know we're in Utah. We have our phones. So there's a lot
think
of
about that, Ken. Don't there's get me a going. Lot.
Yeah. So there's that too. Like you can kind of see like our cell towers getting pinged here. So that's all data that, you know, as people are moving around and they're going to be in places permanently. That's all really, really, really good data, George. And that's the kind of stuff that you want to look at. In my opinion, you want to be ahead of it. You don't want to be a pioneer. You want to be where people are going, and you want to be there in the beginning if you can be.
Yeah, for sure. So long story short, Ken, when we go skiing here in Utah, if I show up without a cell phone, you'll know exactly why.
You need a burner phone and you need to keep yours back in Phoenix.
All right. Let's go ahead and talk about some commercial real estate. When we were at dinner the other night with Kiyosaki, we were talking about some of the local malls that I took a couple classes here. I almost flunked out of high school, but I did take a couple college classes here locally. And this would have been early 90s or so. And back then, these malls that we were talking about, I don't know if you want me to give specific names or anything, but there are a couple of the major malls here. And now, I don't know what the one looks like over by 17, but the one over, we'll say a little further north east is just a complete ghost town. And we all know, you know, we've heard the story of how Amazon is coming in and just destroying the old school malls. But, you know, as a real estate guy, you see the destruction, you see what's going to happen, but you also see this as a huge, huge opportunity. So if you can kind of walk us through that as far as what you see happening to these malls, and then maybe what the opportunity might be for someone to come in and repurpose these things and make a ton of money.
Well, right. Thanks, George. So this was all happening already before COVID. So, you know, you think about the rent in malls is high, and with direct to consumer retail, there's no reason to, is to go, you know, let's say you want to buy a new suit at Hugo Boss or something. Well, they have what they have, and it fits or it doesn't fit, and it's, you know, it's limited to whatever they have. Now you can go to Hugo Boss, you know, their website, and basically order exactly the same size and just take it in and get it tailored if you need. And so there's just, you know, all that was already in motion. And so you already had pretty high rent. Malls are typically very well located right in the middle of town. So the real estate itself is very, very good. But it's all supported by movie theaters, big box anchors like a Macy's, who's filed BK, the one in Scottsdale is Macy's, and Neiman Marcus, both file BK, you know, and then you got all these other small, let's say like California Pizza Kitchen, file BK, you know, you have all these little things. And of course you saw the theaters also file BK. So you have all that stuff happening. And so all of a sudden they can't pay rent. And then that, you know, the rent of course can't pay the mortgage. And so boom. And so that's been going on. It's gotten worse, obviously. And so here we are with these incredible locations that are suffering pretty bad. And so what you will see is you'll see massive redevelopment in those areas. We're already seeing corporate headquarters buy these where people can relocate because of all the parking, and they just repurpose because it, you know, right in the middle of the town. We're already seeing last mile distribution center, you know, with Amazon, because that's their big thing. They want to have that distribution. We're already seeing multifamily redevelopment. And, you know, for me, I look at a big mall and, you know, it might be on 120 acres. I only need 20 acres. You know, I only need like a quarter of the parking lot. And so, you know, you all, as you start to look at, you know, what will work and what won't work, as you start to see these restaurants and some of these retailers go down, you're going to start to see this everywhere. This redevelopment of factories, you know, that was already in process. It's going to be the same kind of a process, I think.
Right. Really interesting. So, boy, with 120 acres of basically prime real estate is what, so most people look at it as a mall, as like an eyesore, but you look at it as 120 acres of primo real estate that you could go in there and potentially buy if the price gets low enough. You buy it for the land, you demo the mall, and then you subdivide it into X, Y, and Z and repurpose the whole property. And that's where you really force appreciation.
Yeah, it's a once of a lifetime, George. I mean, you know, normally big stuff like that is on the edge of town, and then town moves past it, and all of a sudden it's in town. You know, the reason it's on the edge of town is because there's no vacant land. And so, you know, so when I look at something like that, you know, you start to look at these big corners or these big malls, or, you know, some of these big retail centers that may or may not make it, or a factory even, you know, that's how I see it. I see it as a massive redevelopment opportunity. The city loves it because they're not getting any tax dollars. And so they're going, okay, yeah, this is great. And so they're really typically very involved in the overall master plan, but, you know, that could turn into, a mixed use type of a scenario where there's, you know, multifamily and maybe there's some industrial and, you know, maybe there's a school there even. There could be all kinds of stuff. You just never know. It depends on what the city needs.
Yeah. You know, when we get done with the interview, Kenny, remind me, I tell you the story, but it's going to take another 15 minutes of this private equity guy, buddy of mine in Kansas City, who bought a local high school that hadn't been used in years, and he repurposed it into co-working. And yeah. I mean, he just made a fortune out of the deal because the city almost gave him the high school for nothing because it hadn't been used in 30 years or whatever. But anyway.
Yeah. No. And by the way, George, that happens all over the place. Yeah. And so the Falls just happen to be kind of the latest thing. But, you know, those schools have been closing for a long time. Military bases have been closing. And, you know, sometimes they sell those off. So it, and by the way,
they gave him so many tax credits. Ken, he sold the tax credits and used credits.
I know,
refi it.
I think a hidden play here is going to be the universities. You know, they have a lot of real estate around the universities. And I personally think the enrollment's going to shrink down and, you know, it's going to get a real shot in the eye next year. And so I think they're going to take a bit of a hit and there's going to be some really valuable real estate around some of these universities.
Yeah. And there's a lot of community colleges here in Phoenix too. You might be buying one of these community colleges.
Maybe. I can repurpose it.
All right. So I had a conversation with Danielle DiMartino Booth, who's a great friend of mine, and she's just really on top of the real estate from a macro level. She used to work at the Dallas Fed, and she was talking about some research that she had done recently with these boutique hotels that were just being way overbuilt in areas like New York, San Francisco. And they just levered up, you know, their capital structure was all out of whack because they had just very, you know, thin amounts of positive cash flow coming in because they took on so much debt to begin with. And she said, she just went through chart after chart of how they're just in serious trouble right now. And I think that's another thing that we discussed at dinner and where you see as maybe a potential opportunity in the future.
Oh yeah, for sure. So I'm like, this is gonna be, you know, obviously I don't want people to lose money on things, but the truth is that is a fact. You know, I got a bunch of friends that own those. I actually owned a resort and hotel with Robert Kiyosaki and Kim and in Sedona. And, you know, we took it in the chin too. And but I'm not as heavy in it as some others. I will tell you, there's a great YouTube video that I watched with the CEO of Starwood. And it was fabulous. He was pretty palms up about what he saw. And what he said is there could be 30 to 40% of the hotels not make it in New York. And I don't disagree with that. And so again, back to repurpose. And what do we need right now? We need affordable housing. We need senior housing. We need those kinds of things. So when I see a micro hotel sitting that's already developed, somebody spent maybe 15 or 20 million bucks on it and it's owned by the bank, then, you know, if I could buy that thing for 6, 7, 8 million bucks, and turn it into affordable senior, that's a win. It's a win for the senior. It's a win for me. It's not a win for the bank shareholders, but you know, that's the risk that they take when they did the loan.
Right. So you see that playing out in maybe 2021, 2022, and you're going to be as prepared as possible to maybe take advantage of those opportunities in markets where you've done business in the past. And then going back to your good relationship with the bank.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to happen that quick. You know, my experience around on the, you know, the residential is a little quicker, but what happens on the, a lot of times these are owned by, you know, bigger groups and they usually are fighting like crazy to survive. Mm-hmm. And so I think that a lot of the commercial real estate is going to drag out for 2-3 years. Typically that's pretty common. You know, but ultimately at the end of the day, you can only carry it so far.
Yeah, right. Well, Ken, I know we're right at an hour right now looking at the clock and it's just flown by. I could talk to you for another 3 hours very easily. But I remember the last thing that we discussed at dinner the other night with Robert is that you were potentially starting a fund to raise capital to go in and take advantage of some of these opportunities we've discussed. So I definitely want to give you the opportunity to plug that and then talk a little bit more about your YouTube channel, which I would strongly suggest everyone subscribing to. So where can they find out more information about that fund or about what you're doing right now?
Sure. Thank you, by the way. So MC Companies, MCCompanies.com. That's the information that you guys can find out about. So what we're doing, George, is we're looking at these opportunity zones. So when people sell, they can roll their capital gains into these opportunity zones and defer tax. And so that's where my partner Ross and I are heading now. We just finished a raise on a 300 unit apartment building, $50 million in the Tucson area. And so that's primarily what I do full time. And, and then the YouTube channel, Ken McElroy, has been great. It's been so fun to be able to take some of the resources of the, on the property management side, on the finance side, on the construction side, because we have our own construction company, and be able to do YouTube videos, you know, to help people kind of navigate through some of this. And also I've been, you know, I got my butt beat a few times sitting on some of these cycles. I really have, you know, and, you know, we went through it in 08 and, you know, I went through it before that even. And you know, you learn as you go through that, you learn like, that's how I got it. That's why I have reserves, you know? Yeah. So, you know, and so, you know, so I love being able to teach a little bit and make, I don't want anybody to lose any money. There's so much opportunity coming our way, and there's an opportunity for everyone.
Awesome, Ken. Well, thank you for your time. I cannot wait to do it again.
Yeah, for sure, George. We'll see you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.